Thank you very much for having me. Thank you very much for coming and listening. As I know some of you know, when I first started giving the Shechita Shir, they also asked me to run Kaparot here on Erev Yom Kippur. And we did this for a few years, until one fine year somebody called the police. And Baruch Hashem, the university has excellent lawyers, and I was not forced to spend my Yom Kippur in jail. But after that, we decided that perhaps it was better, just because of the legal, environmental, pita, all those issues, perhaps it was better to discuss kaparot, give you the option, I guess. You could go off campus to do kaparot if they have it somewhere. But in the yeshiva itself, specifically in the rooms that are nicely carpeted and painted and stuff like that, we do not do kaparot. So if you want to see the video on YU Torah, you can see how messy these things can get, and I think you'll understand why in this kind of environment, I think you'll learn more, but you won't get the smell of the kaparos, because, yeah, that you need the real thing, but otherwise, the pictures actually are fantastic. As Rabbi Raff said, kaparos is something that, in our religion, is a little bit interesting, because essentially, of course, since it's a halachic issue, the idea of one taking their sins and transferring them in some form or fashion to a chicken, how far that goes. Different Rabbanim have different opinions as to how Jewish such a tradition is. If you take a look on the Nosei Kelim, all the commentaries that surround the Shulchan Aruch, almost all of them warn that if someone's doing kaparot, it's ideal to use a white chicken, but a person should not specifically seek a white chicken, because that looks too much like Darche Amori, which Darche Amori, I'm not really sure how to translate it, but something on not part of our religion, to put it mildly. So on the one hand, it seems that most of the Achronim realize that Kaparot have an aspect which is not necessarily 100% in tune with what we try to accomplish in Erev Yom Kippur. As Rabbi Rat mentioned, if you take a look at the Shulchan Aruch itself, the Mechaber, he writes, and he's quoting the Rashba and the Ramban, that in general, the tradition of doing kaparot with a chicken should be discouraged. And he says that it's, that's as far as he goes. He says, Yishlim Norman Hadzel, let's sort of press it down. And of course, many Sephardi communities don't do kaparot with a chicken, for sure. On the other hand, the Ashkenazim, the Ramah, quoting the Tur, who quotes his father, the Rosh, verbatim, says that the kaparos is an ancient tradition going back to the time of the Gaonim, and it's a beautiful tradition. However you want to understand kaparot and whether it's your tradition to do it, many of the later Achronim point out a great danger with kaparot. And the great danger with kaparot is not whether or not someone is violating Darche Amori, but rather, what happens to the chicken after the kaparot? And the pita issues aside, because it's not the biggest concern, because it really doesn't hurt the chicken to pick it up and wave it around your head three times. But the issue is that the shochtim are overwhelmed. And if you go to any of the kaparot, if you see the kaparot that happen in many neighborhoods in this city, and the Aruch HaShulchan says it was happening in his time also, the shochtim have many, many chickens that they have to worry about, many chickens that theoretically they have to shecht, and it's just not always possible for them to do it appropriately. And if you happen to be driving through Muncie on Erev Yom Kippur, and you keep your eyes open, you will very often see on the side of the road huge flocks of chickens wandering aimlessly through various forests. Because, I don't want to be choshe b'ksherim, but it's theoretically possible that many shechtim, not having enough time to shecht all the chickens, simply release them. And many a times I get calls, people are driving who knows where, New Jersey, I've got, you know, you'll never believe what I saw walking along the side of the road. And I don't need them to complete the sentence. I know what they saw. Erev Yom Kippur, they saw hundreds and hundreds of chickens. And of course, if you're saying on Kapparos and you're saying Zeh HaTarnagol Yelech Lamisa, you're saying this chicken is going to die. There's something to be said for that chicken actually dying. Ideally, we don't want the chicken to die for nothing. We don't want to have Baltashkos. And you also want to have either the chicken being consumed or going for other positive purpose. And this was something that many of the Achronim were very worried about. Because when people were going and they were shechting the chickens, the shechtim weren't doing a good job. The people cleaning the chickens weren't doing a good job. And the whole system, instead of somebody doing a mitzvah on Erev Yom Kippur, or at least of Shechita, Kisui Hadam, maybe Tzakef, they gave the chicken to an Ani. Instead, they're doing some minhag, which might be an ancient minhag, but they're also Chas V'Chalil on Erev Yom Kippur. They could be violating a lot of Isuri Deraisa, including Tarfus, Bal Tashchis, and of course, if you're a Pita member, Tzar Bal Chayim. So what we thought was a good idea, specifically because it is Tzom Gedalia, which has the two very important applications for today. First of all, many people have the minhag to do kaparta on Tzom Gedalia. The other issue is you can't eat anyways, so this is the ideal time to look at the pictures in the pamphlet. And we wanted to go through just the basics of not Hilchot Shechita, but what's involved in A, choosing a kosher bird, and B, making sure that the kosher bird is, in fact, consumable. You'll notice that all the pictures I have here are of a chicken. You'll see that later. I know that many of you are very familiar, specifically if you're learning Chulin, with Rabbi Lach's Sefer Chulin Illuminated. I think it's a fantastic Sefer. He did not focus on chickens. He did give me permission to use his pictures, but this is on chickens. He did it primarily on animals, so there's very little overlap in terms of what we're going to do today. And I invite you to, I think you can keep these booklets. You'll see that the pictures are, Baruch Hashem, the printer worked very well, so they're high quality. Now, if you're doing kapara, or if you're eating a bird, you have to eat a kosher bird. And if you're doing a kapara, you're allowed to use, it seems that there was even a minhag to use animals, but the bottom line is you could use any bird for a kapara as long as it's not one of the birds that's brought on the Mizbeach. In America, you'd think that, well, you don't have too many birds that are brought on the Mizbeach, but the pigeons and the doves, the pigeon, as you know, is a Yonah, and the dove is a Tor, so we're nohig not to use them even if they're wrong age, because we don't want people to think they're actually bringing a korban. So on the first hand, you can't use a pigeon or a dove for a kapara. You can eat them, though. And sparrows, many people are of the opinion that that is the tzipor dror, the bird that the metzora would bring. So if you decide that you want to save a little money and you don't want to do kaparos on a chicken, you can do kaparos on other birds. Just make sure you don't use a pigeon, a dove, and a sparrow. In terms of identifying kosher birds, and that's where, if you want to follow along with me, all the kosher animals, fish, locusts, if you're interested, they have specific signs that they can be identified. If you look in the Torah, right, kosher animals, split hooves, chew their cud. A fish, fins and scales. The locusts, karsulaim, they have a special kind of a leg. With birds, the Torah does not give us any simonim, any way to identify kosher birds. The only way that we can identify kosher birds, theoretically, is we have a list in Vayikra and in Devarim of the non-kosher birds. If you do the math, it comes out to somewhere around 24. And by calculating those 24, any bird not one of the 24, theoretically would be kosher. Obviously, when people were living in Israel, and they had a direct line of Mesorah from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, so people knew which bird was which, people knew that Moshe, whatever Moshe identified as a Nesher, still flying around, father to son, people could identify the 24 birds listed in the Torah. We're not sure when this fell apart. According to some of the Rishonim, it happened already by the time of the Gemara, and for sure by the time of the Rishonim, we could no longer identify the 24 birds that the Torah says are forbidden. to give you an idea of how unsure we are of the 24 species. Of the 24 species listed in the Torah, there is not a single bird which is unanimously agreed among the Rishonim as to its identification. Even the birds that everyone, you know, is taught in grade school, I know everyone's taught the Chasida is the stork, but that's a machlokus between the Rabbeinu Yerucham and the Rosh. The Orev, whether it's a crow or a vulture, and there are many other birds, there's not a single one that the Rishonim agree what it is. So the result is that the list of 24 species that the Torah gives us that are forbidden, it's very important, obviously, but it doesn't help us that much because we can't identify any of the birds on that list. So the Gemara in Chulin, Daf Nun Teh, has a list of four signs through which kosher birds can be identified. And these four signs, we're not really sure of the origins, but it seems that according to the Bali Tosfos, this was a major discovery of probably one of the world's first genuine scientists, Noach. I mean, nobody thinks about this, but Lemaisa, he's stuck on the Teva, 40 days, 40 nights at least, and then while the waters are receding. But when the waters are going up, he had nothing to do, so he's looking at all the animals. And according to the Bali Tosfos, Noach realized that there was a major difference between the kosher and the non-kosher birds. And his discovery is recorded in the Mishnah in Chulin. And it's the Bali Tosfos based this on the fact that when Noach comes out of the Teva, the Torah tells us that he brought a sacrifice from every one of the kosher species. So he was all excited. He made this discovery. He knew which animals and birds were kosher and non-kosher. And in his celebration, when he left the Teva, he sacrificed those that were kosher, those that could be sacrificed. If you take a look at the first page, we have the four signs through which you can identify kosher birds. According to the Gemara, the number one rule is that none of the kosher birds are birds of prey. That means if you think that an eagle might be the nesher listed in the Torah, might be, but for sure an eagle, which we all know is a bird of prey, it can't be kosher. And the identification of a bird of prey in the Torah is slightly different than the scientific definition. And I say slightly different because scientists are constantly revising their definition. The Torah says, I'm sorry, the Gemara says that a bird of prey, when it eats, it uses its foot. And it either stands on its food or it picks its food up with its foot. If you take a look at this picture of a parrot, this is, I don't even know, it's actually a lorry, but it's the same idea. If you take a look at the picture, you'll see that it's holding a grape in its hand and it's eating it. Now, the parrot is strictly vegetarian, theoretically, except for one that lives in New Zealand. But all in all, parrots tend to be vegetarian. They hold the food in their hand, they lift it, and they eat it with their mouth. So according to every single Rishon who has a definition of Doris, the parrot would qualify as a Doris. It also stands, if you take a look at the other foot, the one that's not holding the grape, you'll see there are two toes in front. The parrot has a total of four toes. Two toes face one direction, two toes face the other direction. This bird behaves like a bird of prey. Halachically, we consider it a doris, a bird of prey, but in reality, scientifically, it's not considered a bird of prey. Before we get into, and we won't get into, the scientific aspect, I just want to tell you that, it's 4 years ago, I was at the Museum of Natural History, and I had a special deal with them. Well, they had a problem, because by law, any exotic migratory bird that gets hit by a car or something on the highways, they have to conduct an autopsy. And they had no idea, and they're not allowed to get rid of the birds. There are all these laws of what they have to do with all these birds. So they had tons and tons of dead hawks and owls, and they had no clue what to do with them. So I asked them if I could do research and go and look at all the stomachs. And when I went down, and we'll get to why I was looking at the stomachs later, but when I explained to them that I needed to look at the stomachs, they were mowed in. No one had ever done any research into the similarity between the stomach of a hawk and an owl. But they also asked me, we really know a lot about birds here. What are you looking for? And I said, I want to identify a predator. So they said, well, we have books written about that. And I told them that, you know, in the Torah, we have a tradition. I quoted Rav Sajigon. Rav Sajigon translated to Arabic every one of the non-kosher birds. He happened to have a Masorah on what they were. And he wrote that the Anafa, which is one of the birds listed in the Torah as not kosher, is a parrot. So I told them, I said, listen, in our tradition, we believe that the parrot is very closely related to the falcon. And I know that in scientific literature, that's no longer the case. As luck would have it, they had just been doing research on falcons and parrots at that specific department, and they told me that was their major discovery, that they had cracked the genome of the falcon and the parrot and realized that previously it was assumed that the closest relative to the falcon was an eagle or something like that. And now, when they had further researched the genomes and the, however they look at these things, they realized the closest relative of the falcon is actually the parrot. So then I said, well, so now we're both in agreement they're closely related, but the parrot is strictly vegetarian. And they said, no, that's a mistake. The parrot eats primarily fruits and vegetables. But the breeders, if they want to have super healthy parrots, because the more babies it produces, the more money you get, they feed them meat. And even though the parrot in the wild, in nature, will choose to eat fruits and vegetables primarily, if you can get your parrot to eat meat, I'm not saying you should try this at home, but if you do, you'll see it eats chicken. Once it eats it once, it won't stop. They do much better. And of course, they also mentioned that there were parrots, specifically in New Zealand, which were bedafka predatory, which go and attack sheep and tear them apart. So anyways, in our tradition, the first sign of a non-kosher bird is that it's a bird of prey. The second sign of a non-kosher bird is what we call, if you look on page 6, but the pictures are on all the pages until there too, we have what's called an etzba yeteri. Kosher birds have one toe or part of a toe which doesn't really serve the same function as the other toes. As you saw on the first picture, the first page, the parakeet has four toes and they're all approximately the same size and they all have approximately the same function. If you look on page 6, I have a picture of a chicken and you'll notice on the picture of the chicken that it has the four toes. Toes are numbered, 1, 2, 3, 4. Toe number 2 is extra long and toe number 4 is extra short. Depending on which rishon is your favorite, the extra long toe or the extra short toe doesn't really serve a genuine function for the birds. And if you look at all the kosher birds, they all have a toe which really they don't use. And I don't mean for balance, which if you take a look at how a chicken stands, it doesn't use the fourth toe for balance, but also it can't grab anything with it. When it sits, if you look at the previous page, if you look at page 5, I have a picture of a pigeon. When it's grabbing onto a small twig or something, it also, it doesn't really use its back toe. So it's an extra toe in the extent that its functionality is a bit questionable. You'll also notice, if you're into nature videos and stuff, if you see a picture of an eagle flying with a fish, it will hold the fish in its claws. However, kosher birds are unable to grasp anything with their claws, and they are not able to pick anything up. So if you look at, you know, even the longest legs of a pigeon or whatever that have really long toes, they can perhaps wrap their toes around something, but they can't grab. Their inability to grab also means they can't attack another bird, right? Because they can't grab it and tear it apart. Whereas an eagle can use its claws to scrape and attack. You can get scratched. Don't get me wrong. You can get scratched by a kosher bird, but they can't rip it and tear. All right. The third sign is the zefek, which if you take a look on page 7, I can translate it to English, but I don't know if that'll help you. But if you look at the picture, that's what it is. The zefek is a crop. On the base of the food pipe, there's a little balloon-like sac, which gets bigger and bigger with food. And that's called the zefek. And finally, on page 8, we have what's called the kurkuba niklef biyad. All birds have some kind of a stomach. Birds do not have teeth. Kosher birds, instead of teeth, what they do is they swallow pebbles. And inside the stomach, through the movements of the stomach, they're able to grind their food the way we use our molars. That's called the kurkuban. There's a major difference, and if you take a look, you can see the difference on page 9, between the stomach of a kosher bird and the stomach of the aforementioned owls and hawks, which were so kindly provided by the Museum of Natural History. And that is the kurkuban of a kosher bird is very muscular because they're primarily eating seeds, and things that are harder to break down. Whereas, if you take a look at page 9, you'll see the hawk and the owl actually has a pretty powerful gizzard. But in the bottom page 9, you see the gizzard of a hawk, and that's very flimsy because it's eating primarily meat. So it doesn't need to grind anything up. We have, according to the Gemara, if a bird has all these four signs, the bird is, according to the Gemara, then it's a kosher bird. It cannot be on the list of forbidden species if it has those four signs. However, the last note on the kosher signs, the later Rishonim, noting that this was already a problem, the Gemara realized people aren't so good at figuring out if birds have the four signs. And what was happening, and the Gemara has stories, and the stories get worse and worse as you go through Jewish history, that people thought that a bird had all the signs of a kosher bird, and then they discovered it didn't, and that someone made a miss, you know, they thought it wasn't a bird of prey, and then they saw it, you know, acting like a bird of prey, they thought its krokobun, its stomach would separate properly, and then they reanalyzed and they discovered it didn't. So we, as the Ashkenazi community, have a tradition to only eat birds if we have what's called a Mesorah, which means we have a tradition going back the time everyone knew which were the 24 birds listed in the Torah, and we have a tradition that this bird is not one of those 24 forbidden birds. Once you have an idea of which birds you can eat, I wanted to very quickly go over with you how you could sort of figure out if the bird itself is kosher. If you're learning Kulin, this will be very helpful. If you're not learning Kulin, this is also good, especially if you're doing Kapara, so if you ever want to kosher any meat. Or more importantly, if you're doing kaparos and you want to make sure the meat is kosher. If you take a look on page 11 and 12, I have a kurkuban, one of which, the smaller one, is not nikluf, and the second one is nikluf. The idea, what I told you, one of the signs of a kosher bird is that a kurkuban is nikluf. That means you can grab the kurkuban with your hands, and, I mean, live demonstration, and it'll separate into two membranes. You can see the separated kurkuban on page 11, where you have part of the I don't know what you'd call that yellow thing, right, peels off, and it reveals what looks like a regular piece of meat, especially if you buy your meat in bulk. You'll find that a lot of those are sort of hanging out at the bottom of the bag of chicken. Some people call it pipik. It's the gizzard. If you take a look at this kurkuban, not only does it prove that the chicken, surprise, surprise, is a kosher bird, but it also, you'll see that it's a very, it's a kosher kurkuban. The meat is the right color. Also compliments to Rabbi Kolinsky and the YU printing, but it came out the right shade of the color. Sometimes when you look at a kurkuban, they're deformed, which means that they get discolored. If you get a chicken and it has the right kurkuban in it, and this has happened to a lot of people, and you notice that the kurkuban is the wrong color, you have a real halachic problem, because if the membranes were punctured, so that's it, the chicken's treif. And you can't see necessarily if the kurkuban is cut, how it was punctured, but based on the coloration, you could see the quality of the kurkuban that you have. I have a picture on page 14 of a kurkuban, which, by the way it was cut, we could not tell how it was punctured, but the meat is a totally different color. And what actually happened was there was a children's camp run by the Klausenberg Hasidim. And I lent them animals. They couldn't give it back. It's a long story, but we shechted their ducks. And they had all the Klausenberg children would throw coins to the ducks. And the ducks would eat these coins. I didn't say they were smart ducks. They were just hungry ducks. And they would eat these coins, and they would get stuck in their stomach. So the rubbing of the coin caused this kurkuban to be deformed, and actually was punctured. I couldn't, when we cut, the way a kurkuban comes, if you take a look at the top of page 14, it's closed. So when it was closed, it looked fine. But once we cut the kurkuban open, it was discolored. I couldn't tell if there was any puncture. We went and we asked the Dayanim of Klausenberg, because we were at their camp, and they thought that it was a davar pashut, that it was punctured. But the bottom line is you can see the difference in coloration. If you get a kurkuban that's black, you probably don't want to eat it anyways, because if it's not punctured because of a neck of a specific, you know, metal implement or something puncturing, it's probably diseased. But Hamevin Yavin, but the bottom line is, the second thing is the liver. I have a picture there of a liver on page 15. The livers, very rarely will you find a tarfus with the liver, but there's another interesting issue that we have with livers, which is the age-old machlokus of foie gras. If you compare the picture on page 15 to the picture on page 17, you see what you can do to a liver, especially if you happen to live in France or Hungary, where they're very into doing this, which is you can take a bird and you can stuff it full of food. And it's really, I don't know how to describe it. You basically, you grab the bird, you hold it between your legs, you wrench open its mouth, you stick something down its throat, and then you start stuffing the food down. And if you stuff down its throat much more food than it can eat, it becomes very, very sick. It's called anemic, which means all the blood, for some reason, I'm not the scientist here, drains out of the liver. As all the blood leaves, not only does the liver turn white, anemic, because all the blood of the liver leaves, but the liver gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And by the time the foie gras, the stuffed goose, is ready to be slaughtered, the liver, as you could see in page 17, is bigger than a human hand, whereas a normal liver is probably, you could hold several of them in your hand. There was an age-old machlokus as to whether or not the bird is kosher or not. Lemaise, in America, we don't accept foie gras. In France, they do. The Basin of France of Paris accepts it, as does Bate Din in Brussels, which I think they do whatever the Basin of France does. But you also have in Hungary, there was a time in Israel they were accepting it until Pita got wind of the situation. It's a big machlokus. The OU does not accept foie gras. I'm not trying to entice you to eat it, but I wanted to point out the difference in the livers. We paskin in Shulchan Aruch that a liver is entirely made out of blood. But on the other hand, you can drain all the blood out of the liver, and that is not the reason why people think that the liver is not kosher. The only reason there's a machlokus why the liver is not kosher is people aren't sure if the bird would survive with a liver which is anemic and so much larger than a normal liver. Just so you should do parenthetically, they did tests to find out the different rabbanim, the chassidim and the misnagdim, to figure out if the bird could survive after it was stuffed. And both groups got a bunch of stuffed geese together, and they separated them, and as luck would have it, those people who were the Talmidim of the Rabbanim who said that a goose with a stuffed liver could not survive, all those geese died. And those people who were the Talmidim of people who felt that a goose with a stuffed goose could survive, all those geese survived. There are different theories as to why this happened. Many people ascribe this, of course, to Elu ve'Elu. Other people think that perhaps the geese did not get the same treatment. Many people, perhaps zealous for the covenant of their Rabbanim, made sure that certain geese got treatment like, you know, presidents of this world don't get. Well, you know. Okay. The interesting thing just about stuffed gans, that's the last thing, the stuffed goose, if you look at page 16, I'm sorry, 18. You'll also notice that it doesn't behave like a normal piece of meat. It really behaves like a piece of fat. I'm just showing you in the pictures, you could read the notes, that if you put it over a fire within 15 to 20 seconds, the whole thing turns into just liquid, which makes the shaila of how to kosher it, but that's a different issue. Fatty liver. Oh, thank you. Okay. Rabbi Avidan Elkin, as you know, speaks French, so foie gras is fatty liver. So that would explain why it behaves like fat, I guess. Okay? It does behave like fat, so you do the experiment. Okay, on page 19 and 20, we have lungs. It's much easier than doing the lungs in behemoth, because we don't really look for sirchot or anything like that. The only thing you want to look for lung is, first of all, you don't want the lung to still be in your chicken. If you get a chicken with the lung still inside, if there are pieces of chicken, of lung inside a chicken, then usually it's not a shayla. But if the whole lungs are there, it becomes a shayla in terms of the malicha. But if you take a look at the pictures here, I have on page 19, I have a normal lung. On page 20, I have a not normal lung. The top of the lung is black. Normally, if you clean out a chicken afterwards, depending on how you hold the chicken, this is simple biology, right? Gravity brings it down. So if you shech the chicken, you hold it like that, all the blood is going to go into the lung. If you hold it upside down, all the blood is going to go away from the lung. The other factor, though, is that even if the blood goes into the lung, you should be able to clean it out. And afterwards, the lung should look pretty much normal. If you take a look at this picture, what happened was, I don't know what the scientific terminology is, but we had a lung which had, it was black, ink black, as you could see in the picture, and it was solid. So that's some kind of a disease, and if you look at the Shulchan Aruch discusses black lungs, which, aside from the problem that causes smokers, it's also not good in chickens either, and it's one of the traces. Okay? And again, so that's what you have to look for in lungs. You want to make sure that the lungs are the right color. Sometimes you get lungs that are otherwise deformed, even if it's, again, this is specifically with avian influenza and all that stuff, the lungs that I've been seeing lately have become very good. But there used to be a time when I was first giving my shechita shir, where I would go into the guy who was selling the chickens, and I'd give him extra money if he could give me a chicken that was really, really sick. And inevitably, we would see all sorts of things in the lungs. But now they're scared of the police, so they don't, when you say something like that, they won't let you in their store anymore because they think you're investigating something. But, yeah. I also wanted to show you, just so you could get an idea, page 21, it's the lung inside the chicken. Okay. Finally, the last thing, 22, we have what's called fleshig eggs. Fleshig eggs have very few halachic shilas. Unlike regular eggs, which sometimes have blood spots, but like stuff like that, the fleshig egg is an egg found inside a chicken. If you take an egg from inside the chicken, we treat it as meat, no matter how developed the egg is. If you take a look on the picture I call egg 1.2, I'm not good with the names, I apologize. That little dot in the middle is the approximate size of an egg when it's what's called on the eshkol. If you take a look inside the chicken, and you can see the picture on page 21, the eggs sort of collect in a cluster. It's called an eshkol, like a cluster of grapes. It's a cluster of eggs. And they're very small, and they get bigger and bigger until they're fully formed. The Shulchan Aruch has a lot of discussion about it. But the bottom line is that we paskin that if possible, you should treat the egg as meat at every point from the time it's really small until the time it's fully formed and emerges from the chicken. Of course, the egg when it's fully formed is not really 100% like meat. And if something goes wrong, you can read the Shulchan Aruch, you can read my summaries over here, but you'll see that there is a lot of room to be lenient. But at least l'chatchila, we treat all eggs like anything found inside a chicken as eggs. That's it. I hope that you have a shana tova. If you're zocha to do kaparos, you should know that many people, the Mishnah Berurah suggests this, that even if you do kaparos with a chicken, you should also give a little bit to tzedakah. And of course, many people are nohek only to do kaparos with tzedakah. And if you happen to do kaparos with chicken, of course, there are many most Ashkenazim think that's a good idea. You should also be careful, as the Rosh Hashulchan points out, as many of the Achronim point out, that the meat is properly processed. There's very little benefit to Erev Yom Kippur performing a minhag that chas v'chalila results in someone eating non-kosher food. So I hope that this will help you to understand and to ensure that you're not only zoche to do kaparos, but you're also zoche to, if you so choose, to have kosher meat that you can eat or perhaps give to an ani who doesn't know where the chicken came from. Thank you very much for listening.
Yeah. Does anyone have questions?
Yes. There's a big problem with turkey, which is turkey is a New World bird, supposedly. This is one of the places where I find it interesting that the Haredi world really goes with Darwin. Because Darwin had a bar plukta, someone argues with Darwin, and actually claims that turkey comes from India. But, of course, in the scientific world, you can't argue on Darwin, so we're going to pretend that Darwin's right. And there's a question, how could turkey be kosher? I told you that we only eat birds if we know that it was kosher all the way going back to the days of everyone could identify the 24 species of bird. And nobody, clearly, for the last 2,000 years, could tell you that they know that the turkey was not one of the birds on the 24 list, because even if the turkey comes from India, it still wasn't prevalent in Europe, and it wasn't prevalent in places where there were major Jewish communities. There are a number of theories of why we eat turkey. The reason I'm giving you a number of theories is because I don't think that I could really give you a good answer. The bottom line with turkey is, first of all, my own personal theory, which I'm working to prove, but I have not proven it yet, but I believe it's true, so take it with a grain of salt, is there is a bird that was very common until the Industrial Revolution
in Western Europe called the bustard, the great bustard. And if you go online and you take a look at it, it looks very similar to a turkey. What happened with the great bustard, and it's not related to a turkey at all, was that as soon as people got guns, a big nice bird living in open plains, that was the end of it. It's an extremely endangered species. I got to see some dead specimens at the museum, but there may be 400 around in the world and everyone's trying to get some on their plate. But it looks very much like a turkey. So it's possible that people made the mistake, specifically the people coming to America, they said, oh, that looks like the bird that, you know, we were told was kosher, that we saw. It's also possible the same confusion could have happened with the peacock. If you look at the male peacock, it looks nothing like a turkey. If you take a look at a female peacock, or some of those, there are a number of different kinds of birds that are almost peacocks, the Congo peacock, which many, we don't eat peacocks now, but they were accepted as kosher and had a strong tradition of being kosher. And the females look very much like turkeys. So it's very possible that it was just confused with one of the kosher birds. The other reason that most people give for peacock is, first of all, the Jews have been eating peacock for hundreds of years. And how they started is a question, but by now, we know it's not a doris, we know it's not a bird of prey, and it has all the other signs of a kosher bird. So people think that since we have watched the turkey for so many years, we know it's not a bird of prey, we know Medina the Gemara, it's for sure kosher, so they asked the Netziv about it, and the Netziv said as follows. He said, if you had asked me about the turkey originally, I would not have permitted it. But now you're asking me about it and everybody's eating it. So if I say that the turkey's not kosher, this is the Nativ's words, then really what I'm saying is all those people who ate turkey, that they did something wrong. So now, according to the Nativ, you can look in Shut Meshiv Dover, Chaf Beis, that's 22. He says it goes around 180 degrees. It's no longer that we have to prove the bird is kosher, but to say that it's not kosher, we have to have conclusive proof that it's one of the 24 birds listed in the Torah, and that we can't do. The reality is how it started, we're not sure. Of course, it's also possible that people were eating turkey before the Ramah really was able to popularize the minhag to only eat birds if there's a Masorah. The Ramah was published probably around the time that turkey made its debut in the old world, but the reality is, you know, it wasn't the days of internet. It wasn't like the Ramah sent, and suddenly everyone had a copy of the Ramah. So until everyone got to read all the way to Simon, you know, Pei Beis, it took some time. So maybe by that time everyone said, yeah, of course, we'd never accept a bird against the Ramah, but everyone was already eating turkey. Some people say that the turkey hybridizes with chickens. I want to tell you that's false. For those of you that are biology majors, you can probably read the literature a lot better than I can. But if you take a look at what they did, the experiments to hybridize chickens with turkeys, they could have done the same experiment and not had the chicken involved at all. There was so much, you know, artificial stuff. I've asked people who know a lot more science than I do, and you can look at the research for yourself. There is a breed of chicken called the turkin, and people think that that is a hybrid between the chicken and the turkey. The reason people think that is because it looks like a hybrid between a chicken and a turkey. It looks a little different, I'll give you that. But the reality is that it's not at all related to a turkey, it's just selectively breeding other chickens. Any other questions about birds? Rabbi. The truth about the giraffe. I remember reading something that said, all right, anyways, the OU has poskened that giraffe is kosher, and we actually are confident that we could shecht it. They've twice sent me on a mission to get a giraffe, and the first time, we found, I think it was a perfect giraffe. Young, healthy, lived its whole life in a zoo, well cared for. Unfortunately, the breeder who loved this giraffe, I think its name was James, I'm not sure, before he would sell it to the Orthodox Union, he wanted to come and inspect the facilities that the giraffe would be housed at. In which case, we realized that we weren't on the same page. We said it would be taken care of, it wouldn't suffer. We didn't mean... And the second time we thought we had a giraffe, it was I made a mistake because it was too old. A giraffe costs around $20,000. And if you sheft a giraffe that's progressively older, it's more and more likely that something will be wrong inside, it'll be diseased, In which case,
you don't get to eat it, you just get to shecht it, which is only half the fun. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah, Marcus.
What are the birds that are in controversy?
Pheasants are a subject of controversy. Pheasants are birds that are interesting because the word fezina is mentioned in the Gemara. Right? The Gemara in Bava Kamma says, Tarnagol, Tavis, Ufizioni, Kalayim Zebezeh. So, the problem with the pheasant is a very... very academic problem. We can't get anyone to identify for us what a pheasant is. If you look at Rav Moshe's tshuva, Rav Moshe wrote about a pheasant. He said, if you knew what a pheasant was, and you had a misura that it was kosher, that would count for something. And it's not sure, that's not clear exactly how to understand the tshuva of Rav Moshe, but if you look at the pheasants, you see that Rav Moshe knew very well what he was speaking about when he said, when he talks to the guy and questions his ability to identify a pheasant. There are many, many birds that in English we call pheasants. But if you take a look at the birds, you'll notice that A, they don't hybridize together, and B, the males are radically different. It's just the females happen to have the same, similar color, and even the physiology is different. Some of them have a spur, some of them don't. They're very different birds, they just look the same. And the males are very easy to distinguish, the females aren't. So even if we could establish a misorah, and someone could testify and prove to us that a specific species of pheasant is kosher, we still would need that person to tell us how to identify it in a way that we could make sure we don't confuse it with another bird. And that's really the issue that's coming up with pheasant. They do shecht pheasant in Israel. The OU does not accept pheasant as a bird which we will shecht. We're not saying that we don't think the pheasant is kosher. It's clear from the literature that people accept pheasant as kosher. We just don't know what that bird is. And Bezrat Hashem, if we could prove it, so then of course we would allow pheasant. So we have issues now with partridge. We're working currently on a project with these, they're called partridges. It's the Latin group of Electoris, which is a kind of, there are a whole bunch of birds in that group. The problem is that the bird is very segregated geographically. And there are some birds that lived only in Italy, and some birds lived only in southern Russia. And scientists consider each one to be a specific species. And at the OU, we will only accept birds, and this is the way most of the Achronim Paskin, if there was a Misorah, not just one person, not that one person said, hey, I remember, 50 years ago we ate the bird, but there was a large community with Talmidei Chachamim that accepted it as kosher and nobody argued. The problem is that since the partridge is considered a different species in each area, is it that there are a whole bunch of little misoras? In Italy, they accepted one partridge as kosher. And in southern Russia, they accept another partridge as kosher. In Algeria, they accept another partridge as kosher. Or are all these little partridges really the same species? In which case, it seems that everyone in the world accepted this bird as kosher. And it's from the scientific literature, it seems that all these birds will hybridize together, they'll breed together, they'll produce viable offspring together, etc., etc. And currently, they're in the male. And after Sukkot, Bezrat Hashem, we're going to start bringing them around to the various Rabbanim to see if we can get some consensus that they're all the same species. If they're all the same species, then we'll start shefting them. And if they're not all the same species, so we have to figure out if any of those communities is chashuv in its own right, so that we would accept their misorah. Yeah? Right. A lot of people have attacked, not the OU, but... that there's a lot of controversy into what we accept as a misorah for a bird, where certain communities are, I guess, will make it discriminated against. The reality is that nobody really feels that a certain community is not allowed to have a misorah. You don't have it that we look at least the OU poskim. There are people who don't accept anybody except their own, but that's, the greater Rabbanim in Israel and the OU, we won't say, oh, this guy comes from the island of Jerba, which had a tremendous misorah on kashrus and stuff like that, and we don't accept Jerba. That's not the issue. What happens is that the achronim are nervous that people confuse birds. So if you come from one community, let's say you come from, what happened in America in the 1800s, where all in the south, all the shechtim had a misorah that a certain bird called the Muscovite duck was kosher. And nobody was saying to them, we think you're liars. No one's saying to them, you don't know how to learn. No, we know that they paskin like the Rama. The question is, what's their origin? How did it start? And when the research was done, this was happened in the days of Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch wrote a tshuva on it, as did Rav Nosson Adler of London. The reality was is that America didn't have a long lineage of Talmidei Chachamim. So how could a bird that everyone in America, this was in the South, the machlokas happened at the same time as World War II. I'm sorry, not World War, the Civil War. So it's very interesting, the Shalos HaTshuvos that were coming out, because you see them back to back with questions about slavery and stuff like that. But Lamaisa, how can we accept a Mesorah that the basis of it could be based on nothing? So even though, whatever you say about all the Jews who lived in the South, there were no Talmidei Chachamim there. So just because all the Shechtim accepted it doesn't mean that much. Similarly, let's say you have one small community that has Talmidei Chachamim, but it's not a community which has millions of people in it. So maybe one time somebody made a mistake, or somebody pointed to a bird and said it was kosher, and you know the guy watching didn't have such good eyesight, and he didn't chop the right bird. But the Chas V'Cholil said that all of Klai Yisrael made a mistake, that's impossible. So when we need a Mesorah, we require that it be widespread and well accepted, not that we say that one community is not entitled to halachic opinion. We don't discriminate against anybody. It's just if they're a validity. And also in some of the Sephardi countries, and this is not against Sephardim, it's against the way that the Shochtim behaved. I went with, just as an example, Rav Ben Chaim, who I think is, he taught me Shrita, the highest amount of respect, and he took me to a Schlachhaus to show me different things about birds. And we got to one group of birds called guinea fowl. And he told me, he said, I know they shechted this in Iran, but I don't know if the shechtim could be relied on. And he claimed, and of course, I never lived in any Sephardi country, so I can't tell you from first-hand experience, but Ben Chaim claims that in a lot of the Sephardi countries, the shechtim were not the same caliber as the shechtim in Ashkenazi lands. Not in terms of their ability to do shechita, but in terms of how the community respected them. And if you look in the histories of shtetls, it was really the rabbi and the shochet. Really, the rabbi and the shochet. We'll put it in perspective. But the shochet was also considered, he had to be a Talmud Chacham, a Yirei Shamayim. You look at the Shulchan Aruch, you look at the Achronim, what they write. And unfortunately, in many of the Sephardi lands, the shochet was looked down on, and he wasn't necessarily a Talmud Chacham of the caliber that someone would rely on him to establish a Mesorah. Yes, Rabbi Willick. I can't hear him, sorry. I will do that, but I don't have any pictures, so I'm always scared to do something where I can't show you. But the shechita of a bird is very, I mean, the turkey, for example, it's the easiest, but you want to just cut with whether you're shechting an animal or a bird, you want to cut the food pipe and the windpipe. You want to completely sever them. However, we paskin that if you shecht the majority of one in a bird, either the majority of the food pipe or the majority of the windpipe, the bird is kosher. And with an animal, you have to shecht the majority of both the food pipe and the windpipe. That good, or should right? We're very nervous. I shouldn't say we, because this decision is people way above me at the OU. But the heads of the OU are very nervous about animal rights, not because of the halachic concerns, but we see them gathering their forces against us. And in a lot of European countries, as you know, shechita is outlawed. And there's a significant concern that, and they would love to do this. You just have to look at their website. They would love to assur shechita. It's not purely anti-Semitic. They don't want people eating birds in general. But the animal rights activists are constantly trying to show that shechita is barbaric so that they could get it made illegal, in which case we'll have a big problem. So the OU is constantly trying to make the animal rights activists happy, but not from a halachic perspective. Because as you know, if you need to do something for human consumption, so look, there's no way you could kill an animal without causing it any pain or any discomfort. On the other hand, if we can minimize it, why not? But we're under very heavy attack. And I recommend that you look at the PETA website, the Humane Society website, look at what they're writing about shechita, and you'll see that Bezrat Hashem won't be a problem, but they're trying. Yeah, right, Mark.
So that's what I showed in the pictures. Really, it's very unlikely that you're going to have, because we have a lot of bodkin, especially if you buy OU meat. You shouldn't have any problems with your chickens. The main problem is that you'll see discoloration. If you take a look on page number 14, you'll see the discoloration of the gizzard. But sometimes if you buy, let's say, a piece of meat and you see that the leg is broken, the wings are broken. So if there's no discoloration, you don't have to worry, because the break probably happened after the shechita. Whereas if there's discoloration, that implies that whatever broke before the shechita, in which case the bird was a trefa. As you know, that you can chop up meat, and there's no halachic shaila if the meat is dead. But if something gets broken before the shechita, so very often it can be a trefa. At the outside of the bone, where the break is, it looks like, you know, it's healed. The color that I've seen most often is that color that I have on page 14. The meat. The bone's not going to... I've never seen a bone that's discolored. I mean, just because, you know, it's just...
Right,
around the joint, or sometimes a little bit higher, a little bit lower. Yeah. I really don't know that much. Well, I read a lot about pita, but I don't really know how they run or anything like that. I'm sorry, you can have your own theory. If you think it's anti-Semitic, you might be right. I might be wrong. I'm saying that publicly, but... I'm sorry? No. That they're not saying. They would rather be electrocuted, which is... That's the Sri Deish. If you look at his Shalos HaTshuvos, I think the first volume almost is totally devoted. He felt that it was mutter, right, to electrocute the animals. But the bottom line is that I've gone into slaughterhouses when they electrocute the animals, and I always like, I do experiments. I said to the guy, how much do I have to pay you that you run the line twice? All the animals are electrocuted because they have them on a conveyor belt. People are birds. They had all the birds on the conveyor belt. I said, run it again. Run around, let all the birds wake up. Then run again, re-electrocute them in Florida. And he said, you're not going to wake up. So the bottom line is that I don't know how they were doing this electrocution, but basically what they have is they have, it looks like a pool of water, and it's electric water. And they have the birds on the conveyor belt, and the birds are dumped for a second in this water, and it electrocutes them. And they're frozen. They're going to instant rigor mortis, and then they slaughter them. So we posit that the bird is dead, or theoretically very likely dead, by the time he gets to the showcase, and that defeats the whole purpose of shechita. The Goyim claim that it feels no pain. And that's what they would like us to do. They'd like us to immobilize the animal before the shechita. And the only basis that they have for saying that it's less painful is there's a certain chemical that the nerves produce. If anyone knows the science, please correct me on this. Oh, so what's the advantage of the electrocution? Please.
Okay, sorry, this was really an unexpected surprise appearance. So just a little bit in terms of my experience when I was a veterinary student, we had to do slaughterhouse work, and different species of animals that, well, first of all, just before we get into that, what the secular world would prefer in terms of slaughter is the animal not be conscious while it's being slaughtered. That's the point. So really in most civilized countries, there's a special tour, if you will, for kosher slaughter, meaning that you're exempt from stunning the animal before the slaughter is done. That's the difference. In other countries which don't permit shechita, the reason is because they don't have this patur, they don't have an exemption. But any civilized country demand requires that the animal is not conscious when the throat is cut. Rabbi Loki, you mentioned a couple of different methods of creating this situation where the animal is not conscious. One of them is what's called a captive bolt, that which is used in large animals, that the animal is brought, just before its neck is cut, the animal is brought to the end of the line, so to speak, literally and figuratively. And there's a gentleman standing there with a gun which has not bullets, because that would be too expensive, but a bolt, a metal pin, a thick metal pin which penetrates the skull, and it penetrates the consciousness center of the brain, and then the bolt is then retracted back into the gun so it can be reused. The theory again is that if the man hits the right spot, then the animal is not conscious anymore, and then the next step is they cut its throat and bleed it out, and everyone's happy except for the animal. What's that? You're saying in terms of kashrus? Yeah, well, absolutely. That will make the animal into a trefa, for sure. There's no question about that. That will penetrate the meninges. That's the covering of the brain, and that would make the animal into a trefa. So of course that's not permitted by kosher slaughter, but just in terms of animal rights, etc. In the slaughterhouse work that I did, you can imagine that most of the people who this is their job, standing there shooting animals in the head all day, are not exactly the highest of the highest strata of society, and unfortunately, you know, the guy that's near his lunch break, or he's getting bored, so he's not concentrating so much. And I observed, often it happened that they didn't exactly get the right spot. And then the animal is still conscious, the animal's screaming in pain, and then they have to do it again. So, again, in theory, it's very nice that the animal's not conscious, but when you put it into practice, it doesn't always happen that they... And I'm understating it when I say it doesn't always happen that they get the right spot. So that's a major problem. Then in terms of medium-sized animals such as sheep, so they usually electrocute them as well, just as they do for chickens. So in many slaughterhouses, they have the sheep walk through a narrow pen, and they have electrified rods that go along the sides, and the sheep kind of brush up. Rabbi Loki, have you seen this before? Yeah. The sheep kind of are forced to brush up against these electrified wires, and that stuns them. In theory, it renders them unconscious, and then again at the end of the line, there's someone there to cut their throats and bleed them out. But the problem with this is that they don't want to make the electric current too high, because if they do, then there's vasoconstriction, the blood vessels constrict, and that forces blood to come out, the capillaries to burst, and then you have red spots in the meat, and the customers don't like that very much, so they try not to up the juice, so to speak. So the voltage is relatively low, but the problem is that if the voltage is too low, then the animal gets paralyzed and it's still fully conscious. So basically they're defeating the whole point of it and making it even worse, that the animal is frozen there but is fully aware of what's going on, and certainly is suffering a tremendous amount, probably a lot more than the animal would in terms of shechita. And then a similar concept as Rabbi Loki described is for birds as well, for chickens, that they're electrocuted as well. But again, they don't want to make the current too high, because then they'll have blood spots, red splotches in the meat. So again, who knows if those birds are really fully unconscious or just paralyzed. In terms of shechita, whether... how quickly it renders the animal unconscious. So that's a discussion. But in theory, if the knife, the chalaf, the knife that's used for shechita is very sharp, the animal should not feel the cut. And in theory, the carotid artery, which is supplying blood to the brain, and the jugular vein, which is taking blood away from the brain, Both of those are cut. Generally, if you're cutting both simanim, they cut automatically. And what you have is blood, the blood supply to the brain being cut off immediately. The blood that's in the brain is draining out very quickly. So basically, the brain does not have a blood supply almost immediately, and that renders the animal unconscious again almost immediately, hopefully before it's aware even that it's being cut. So in theory, if the shechita is being done properly, that should not be a problem. There's a question that arises in younger animals, in calves, for example. There's another artery called the vertebral artery, which runs in the vertebral canal and supplies blood to the brain that way, and that obviously is not cut during shechita because the shechita knife shouldn't go all the way to the vertebrae anyway. So that's a controversy among scientists. Usually that artery attenuates, gets smaller as the animal ages. So we generally assume it's not a major problem. But again, there are anatomists. When I was in veterinary school, there were some of my anatomy teachers who probably had a streak of anti-Semitism in them anyway. That was a point for them that they were complaining about. But another issue that may come up in terms of shechita is how the animal is restrained for shechita. And I'm not sure what the OU standards are, requirements for large animals in terms of restraining.
Our first requirement is that the show could be safe.
Okay.
But the second one is we need to have they have a pen that they move the animal into and then they pull up its neck.
Right.
And you can't shift it that way, you have to be shifted.
Right. Because there was a very fascinating person, there is a fascinating person, Temple Grandin, who's she's autistic, but she has this simple empathy with animals, and she went into designing slaughterhouses and slaughterhouse technology. And in the course of her work, she came across a shochet, and she was very impressed with his sensitivity and his intelligence. And she decided that she wanted to help slaughterhouses design restraining methods for the animals that are humane. So she came up with a restraining mechanism that besides clothes on the animal, so the animals feel safer when they're herding together. So the animal feels like it's being surrounded by other animals, so it feels more comfortable. And then there's a hydraulic lift that lifts the neck up, and then according to her system, the shechita should be done that way, which has lots of potential problems. If the shochet is going against gravity, we're afraid that maybe he'll press too hard, and that will puzzle the shechita.
Or the weight of the neck.
The weight of the neck coming down. So ideally, the animal should be on its side or on its back, but this leads to other problems. In the old days in America, they used to have hoisting and shackling. They would put a chain on the animal's hind leg, raise the animal up, the animal would be dangling, this huge animal dangling from its dainty leg and swinging around, not very safe for the shochet, and then the shochet would sort of wrestle with this kicking cow and then do the shechita. Lots of problems with that in terms of trefus, that the hind leg may become dislocated because of the weight. All the weight of the rumen, which is the animal, one of the stomachs, which is huge, it's really a factory. All of this pushing down on the animal's lungs can also cause the animal to become a trefus. So then they developed other techniques as well. There's the rotary pen, which they use in England. Right? They put the animal in this pen and it rotates, and then the shochet does the shechita. Or otherwise they do a combination of chain and animal falling on its side, which they do in Eretz Israel. Jay, do you have a question? No. There are a whole number of issues. Well, first of all, the shechita, the animal would have to be facing the guillotine. It would have to be upside down. Guillotine, usually in the good old French tradition, the knife meets the back of the neck. which is, first of all, that's a problem in terms of Shechita. So, well, also we need Koach Adam, we need a human being directly involved in this. So there's a whole discussion in the Talmud about that, but basically also we need a back and forth motion of the knife. So basically decapitation with a guillotine for many, many reasons is not viable. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Yeah, maybe you can answer that.
It depends on how equipped the facility is. The real problem the real problem that they have, which is why we don't do shechita super fast, is what holds us up is not the shechita, but the bedikos, checking the rails. So there's really not a lot of motivation to kill the animal super fast, because the real problem in terms of speed is how fast they can inspect the lungs. Interestingly enough, you should know that it's much easier and cheaper in terms of checking to get glatt kosher meat than not glatt kosher meat. Because if the guy's a Yiri Shemayim, anything that has a slight imperfection, so they're not going to sell it as glatt. They just sell it to the Goyim, and they can quickly go through it. You know, you just have to say yes or no. But if you're selling the meat as not glatt, but you're Yiri Shemayim and you want it to be kosher, then you really have to do all these checks into the lungs, and it takes a long time, so it's a lot slower. But it really depends on, you know, how many people they have and what they want to do in terms of checking. I'm sorry? I don't know if that's true. I thought it was used. Yeah. Yeah, because the pizza guys don't know where we're doing it in Argentina, so they keep away. Yeah. There's no way I could teach you without pictures, but the reality is that glatt kosher meat and non-glatt kosher meat in America, we really, I mean, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but if it's not glatt, chances are it's not really kosher. I don't know what the situation is in terms of every single slaughterhouse, but in general in America, there's not really so much of a segregation. There are different minhagim between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, and if you look at the Shulchan Aruch, there are different parts of the lung which have different kinds of problems. And that's that in America, there also isn't a difference from what I understand between Beis Yosef and regular Ashkenazi. But this is, the glatt really means that, I guess that's your question, right? Glatt means that there's no pieces of lung. If you can imagine, a lung is really like five bags, three on one side, two on another. And the bag should not have a piece of lung, you know, going from one to another or, you know, back and forth. And that's what glatt really looks at, is if there's these real pieces of meat. And it has to do with if the animal's lung had been punctured and it healed itself and stuff like that. But the difference in America, we don't really have any like reputable kashrus organizations which certify non-glatt meat. There are other communities which were a bit more lenient and were not makpid on glatt, but they're not represented in America, and I really can't tell you what coolers they use because I've never looked into it. Yeah. How could I say it's treif? I know that the OU doesn't certify it. I wouldn't eat it. I don't know what they claim. I mean, the reality is that we just had a problem, actually, an Erev Rosh Hashanah. We had a problem Erev Rosh Hashanah. There's a guy who we think is a Yiri Shamayim, and he opened an establishment which we refused to certify because this guy, he's an expert shochet, but it's his business, and he is the shochet, he is the bodek, and he is also the one who makes the parnasa. And we feel, just as an example, that that kind of, I don't know, establishment, it's a conflict of interest. How maybe this guy's a Yirish Shemayim, a Tzadik Gomor, and he'd never do anything wrong, but someone who makes a profit, let's say, on each one, so there's something wrong there. And I can't say, I've never been to Hebrew National, I've never looked at their shritas, I can't tell you what they're doing, but the way it's set up is not to the satisfaction of, for sure, the OU, and I think most of the other kashrus organizations. But that doesn't mean that's not kosher. I don't know. Yeah? Right. So Israel has a major economic problem, which is that they don't have anything to do with meat that's not kosher. In America, it might even be cheaper, you know, in terms of manpower, as I said before, to have black kosher meat. Because you look at it, if it's perfect, you keep it. Otherwise, you sell it to the goyim. And they don't care. And it's, you know, Rabashkin, for all that we say about their kosher meat, they also have a huge distribution of non-kosher meat. Because they don't care. They just send it, and the market's pretty good. In Israel, of course, there aren't enough goyim to sell all the non-kosher meat. So they have a lot of kulas there. And I'm not going to sit here and chas v'chalila say anything on Sirs Mechuvah about what's going on with the kosher meat in Israel. But it depends on, first of all, if you look, right, for it to be God or not. If you don't look, you're not going to find anything. And, yeah?
It's not even that they're going to go to the tradition, then they have to not do it. Going back to verse. So the theory you're starting that the fusion of the site is this story, and now they're reading it, and we're going to use the Masorah, where we have
it. Thank you, Rabbi. You're 100% right. And Rabbi Maybrook was asking, if the Sephardim have a different understanding of what's a Masorah than the Ashkenazim, so how can we rely on them? So first of all, at the OU, before we rely on a Sephardi Masorah, we research what the basis of their Masorah is. Many of the Sephardi communities, including Teman, including Morocco, and I haven't had to research every single community, many of their Gedolim did not rely on the Machaber, and they actually paskined according to the Ramah. So if they're paskined according to the Ramah, they're saying we would only eat a bird if there was a tradition going back to, you know, so they're fine. On the other hand, there are communities where they do specifically rely on Simanim. And then Rabbi Maybrook, of course, we respect them. They have a malismo, that's for sure, but we can't share their exotic meats together. Yes? Well, I mean, I don't think this is radical. They're not doing anything with kashrus. They're just saying that they think the workers are treated nicely. So it's not really a kashrus question. It's what they're trying to do is, I don't think it's going to have any impact on shchita. It's not going to have any impact on making food kosher. It's going to have impact on other things if they actually get it off the ground. Yeah. So what I just mentioned was the partridge. The partridge, that Masorah, a lot of the partridges that we identify come from Sephardi land, and it probably will be accepted. That's my guess. I'll have to tell you in a month from now. They're also the turkey. If you look at the earlier poskim, the Masorah of the turkey, if it exists, came from Sephardi lands. I'm not saying that it does exist, but if it does. And there are a lot of, specifically the Sephardim in Yerushalayim, you know, there were what we call the chicken wars. I don't know why that's what it got called, but in the late 1800s, there were a lot of shilas regarding exotic breeds of chickens, if they were kosher or not. And they were constantly sending the shilas to the Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael, but they were Sephardi Rabbanim, to ask them, you know, how they held from these things. Yeah. So Chagovim are a different problem. First of all, the market is a bit limited. They're grasshoppers. I think locust is more correct, but if you take a look at the Torah describes, in vague terminology, what's a kosher locust. The locusts that there's one community that I know of, well, I think there are also Moroccans who... Oh. Right, okay, right. So, there were communities that eat locusts in the past. The Taimanim still claim that locusts are kosher. The Ashkenazim, it was really, I think, the Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank who really sort of put his foot down. there was a time in the early days of Medina Israel where there was shortages of food. And it just so happened, I don't know if they caused the shortage or just with luck, that there was a plague of locusts at the same time. So the Taimanim were eating like kings, and the Ashkenazim, these were the Bachrim in the yeshiva, you understand. So the Taimani Bachrim were eating like kings, and the Sephardi Bachrim, Ashkenazi Bachrim were starving. And they were told still not to eat the locusts. The basic problem from there are a lot of people of different opinions why we should or should not eat locusts. But it basically comes down to what's called Ushmo Chagav, that even though the Taimanim have a Mesorah that a locust is kosher, there are a number of different kinds of locusts listed, and they are unable to correlate that specific locust with the biblical locust, with a specific biblical locust. So they have a Mesorah, it's kosher, but which one? And we Taina, for a Mesorah, it's not enough that you know it's kosher, you have to be able to correlate, which one is there. Which one of the locusts it is that's on the list of locusts that theoretically we could eat. Any other questions? Yeah. There's not really so much of a difference. There once was a huge difference between Ashkenazi, meaning Chassidisha, and non-Chassidisha Shechtim. Some people think this is what put, well, one of the many reasons that they put the Baal Shem Tov in Kher, was how you made a Shechita knife. But the difference is ignored now. In terms of the actual Shechita, that was your question, right? I mean, the only problem I think that we have is really if you're eating, some people have a lot of problems with the Sephardi meat, like the red meat. But I've never heard anybody say that we have to I've never heard, I don't know, greater about it here than me, I'm not going to touch this one. And not only that, but they start earlier. Thank you very much for your listening.
Are you still going?
The rules are supposed to do two of them.